That was Lloyd Cole and the Commotions with Rattlesnakes, a classic animal song of sorts to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Jonathan Balcom, an animal behavior scholar, animal advocate, and author of four books, most recently The Exultant Ark, a pictorial guide of animal pleasure. The new book features dozens of often stunning photographs documenting various types of animal pleasure, accompanied by scholarly texts from Balcom, who holds a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior. We'll find out more about the book, about how Balcom's work studying and observing animal pleasure makes him something of a pioneer, if not rogue, and more when we speak with Jonathan Balcom in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the Comedy Corner, which involves animal comedy. Play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Thunder Dog, the book by last week's guest, Michael Hinkson. And we'll hear an animal song or two consistent with today's animal pleasure theme, including the Name That Animal Tune selection. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment. Look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. Produced by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. As always, our first item, took this from the Washington Post. California, the headline is, California adopts shark fin ban. The California Senate passed legislation Tuesday that would ban the trade, sale, and possession of shark fins, rejecting arguments that the conservation measure discriminates against Asians who consume shark fin soup. If Governor Jerry Brown signs the measure, California will be the fourth state in the U.S. to ban shark fin imports. Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington already have done so. Activists have begun pushing for shark fin bans across the U.S. in an effort to combat the global shark fin trade, which scientists estimate kills between 26 million and 73 million sharks a year. Quote, it's a great day for sharks in California, said Michael Sutton, vice president for the Monterey Bay Aquarium Center for the Future of the Oceans, whose group co-sponsored the legislation. They may now actually survive for another 450 million years. As a compromise, the Senate adopted language that would ban imports as of January 1st, but allow those who possess shark fins to dispose of their stocks until June 30, 2013. They also included provisions that would allow fishermen who legally catch sharks to keep the fins for their personal use or donate them to taxidermists, research, or medicinal institutions. The initial vote count was 25 to 9, though the final vote could change in the next day since California senators can submit absentee votes in the hours after a vote. A majority of both Democrats and Republicans voted in favor of it. Here's something cool. If you're a music fan, a Flaming Lips fan, and an animal fan, it all rolls together. This says, ever wonder how much it would cost to buy yourself into a Flaming Lips track? After an announcement today, that was yesterday, I believe, it's no longer a mystery. The answer is $100. The Flaming Lips announced today that fans can have a part in their new freakishly long six-hour track, which is now titled Found a Star on the Ground. Frontman Wayne Coyne announced it today on Twitter, and it seems like the offer will only be available for a limited time. It's still up now. I just checked right before the show. But Wayne Coyne said on Twitter, we'll be recording all day, but the proceeds, that's the key thing from this, from the track, if you do pay your $100 to be on it, are going towards a good cause, the Oklahoma Humane Society and ACM at UCO. So you can find out more by going to Flaming Lips 6 Hour. That's all spelled out, all the words, 6HourSong.com. All right, more locally here. Florida Voices for Animals annual dog and car wash fundraiser is coming up this Saturday, September 10th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Rolling Oaks Market in Tampa. That's 1021 North MacDill Avenue in Tampa. And it says, we'll wash your dog, your car, or both. Come support a wonderful cause at this fun time fundraiser. More information can be found at floridavoicesforanimals.org. And I'm sure I got this, but I just thought I should include it. Police admitted, quote, assistance comes in the strangest forms after a parrot helped catch a burglar by squawking a warning to his owner. The pet became agitated after an intruder broke into his home in Walden, North Tynesdale, and he woke his owner by calling out. Police were called, and a 32-year-old woman was arrested after the break-in on Wednesday. Temporary Detective Inspector Dave Watson said, quote, at one incident last week, the offender disturbed the occupant's parent, which woke the victim, occupant's parrot, resulting in a woman being charged with burglary. Sometimes assistance comes in the strangest forms. Indeed. And this was sent to me by Sean Canan, WNF's Assistant News and Public Affairs Director. It comes from AP, headlined, Colorado Dog Celebrated for Having Such Long Ears. Boulder, Colorado Harbor has over 2 feet of ears. Does that make him a 6-foot-long dog? Probably not. But on Tuesday, the black and tan coonhound from Boulder, Colorado gets the 2012 Guinness World Records title for longest ears on a living dog. His left ear is 12.25 inches and his right is 13.5 inches long. Owner Jennifer Wirtz says when her eight-year-old was a puppy, he would trip on his ears and roll down the stairs. These days, where it says people often stop them to ask questions, take photos, or tug on his ears. Coonhounds use their ears to help with scent. Back locally on the Save the Date front, the Greyhound Support Transport is having its fall picnic Sunday, October 2nd at Eagle Lake Park. It's 1800 Keene Road. They're holding it at Shelter 2. That's in Largo. It's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., and it's for humans and four-legged friends of all types. There'll be a barbecue, silent auction, raffle, and a few extra surprises. They are looking for folks to RSVP, ideally by September 25th, to greyhoundsupporttransport@gmail.com. Or they do have a Facebook page as well. They just want a bit of a head count to know how much food to have on hand, etc. And all funds raised at this event will benefit Greyhound Support Transport in moving retired greyhounds to non-racing states. And lastly for now, we'll come back to some more later, the second annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest is coming up. You probably have marked your calendars, but if not, it's October 15th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Cotinchobee Fort Brooke Park in downtown Tampa in honor of World Farm Animals Day. The park is located behind the St. Pete Times Forum on the Hillsborough River. Admission is, well, we can't say, but let's just say that you came over and you left your wallet at home. You can still get in, pretty much, right? So there's educational exhibits and events, including activities for children. Companion animals on leashes are welcome. The event will include healthy living and eco-friendly exhibitors. Nationally known and local speakers, nonprofits. One of the speakers, by the way, Carol Leifer, we talked about at length last week, but great comedian, great animal person, author of a great book, When You Lie About Your Age, the Terrorists Win, and she's just going to be terrific, and as all these speakers will be. And they'll have nonprofits, booths, fun and games for kids, dog and cat adoptions, food from the local veg operations, and more, live music, entertainment. So all that and more with details can be found at TampaBayVegFest.org. All right, we'll get into some more animal news later, hopefully, but right now it's time to step into the Talking Animal Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Jerry Seinfeld with a portion of a piece called Horses on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animal.
I've tried horseback riding. I can't really do that. And they don't really give you the good horses when you're not good at it. I found that out. Guy says, what level rider would you say that you are? I go, I don't know, zero, nothing, whatever the system is. I can't do it. Is that clear enough for you? I'm going where the horse wants to go, okay? That's my level. Now, of course, they hear that, they start looking around. All right, is glue stick back yet? How about almost dead? Why don't you saddle him up? So I get on this U-shaped, lightning-quick steed I got here. I had the only horse you could put your feet flat on the ground while you're riding it. I'm riding a hammock here. I'm looking up at my friends. I don't feel like we all got the same kind of horse. It was kind of a secure feeling. I could just kind of walk along with them there. Anyway. And the horse isn't too thrilled with having me either. The horse knows they may be dumb, but they know you can't ride. And they don't like it. They just stop, you know, and they look up at you. With that frightening horsey face, you know, with those huge nostrils and that big bowling ball eye. And chill out, Hopalong. I know the trail. Yeah, I'm here every goddamn day, okay? And I really appreciate the kicking while I'm taking a leak, too. Yeah, thanks a lot. That really improves the already wonderful life that I have. People either sitting on me or kicking me while I'm peeing. I've got a real sweet gig here at the ranch.
All right. That was Jerry Seinfeld with a portion of a piece called Horses, taken from his album I'm Telling You for the Last Time. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Jonathan Balcom. As I touched on earlier, Jonathan is an animal behavior scholar, animal advocate, and author of four books, most recently The Exultant Ark, A Pictorial Guide of Animal Pleasure. The new book features dozens of often stunning photographs documenting various types of animal pleasure. But the book functions as far more than a gallery of top-notch photos depicting animals in various bouts of bliss, accompanying, as it is, by text written by Jonathan, who holds a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Jonathan Balcom to Talking Animals. Good morning, Jonathan.
Hi, Duncan.
Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
So, in a moment or two, of course, want to delve into the specifics of the book in various ways. But first, though, in examining animal pleasure, to some extent, sort of submitting that it exists, you sort of identified yourself as something of a scientific rogue, a lone wolf, if you will. Since much of your work in recent years has operated in this territory, maybe you could describe sort of the initial factors, scientifically, academically, otherwise, that led you onto this path of exploring animal pleasure.
Sure. Well, there's no question it's been neglected by scientists. I studied biology for 10 years at three different universities, and I don't think I ever saw a textbook or heard a lecture that mentioned pleasure in animals, at least not explicitly in its own right. It may have been collaterally mentioned, but it's really been neglected. And about 10 years ago, I was observing an interaction between two crows in Northern Virginia. I'm a avid bird watcher, and the crows behaved in a way that was clearly motivated by the desire for reward or pleasure. And scientists certainly understand reward. I think the basic problem with this is that it's considered what's called a private experience. Feelings are private, and so scientists are very reluctant to make assumptions about other species' private experiences, and that's probably why there's been so little talk about animal pleasure until recently.
And until recently, does that mean chiefly your work, or are there other colleagues that are starting to explore work in the same territory and therefore hoping maybe tearing down some of the resistance that you've hit so far?
Right. Well, there's been a smattering, but very little. I mean, there's been a little bit of work with rats, some studies with iguana lizards, but really very little. And it's certainly my hope that by writing, I've written two books now dedicated to this subject.
Yeah.
It's my hope that those books will stimulate more interest in the study of animal pleasure, although certainly my audience is mainly the general public. I'm not primarily reaching out to scientists. Nevertheless, scientists can reveal a great deal about animals in their lives, so I hope they too will be stimulated to investigate further into the pleasurable aspects of animals' existences.
And with that sort of game plan and sort of focus in mind, what kind of hope do you hold out that you know, more in the scientific community will sort of come your way?
So far, there hasn't been an awfully strong reaction to my work, positive or negative, from the scientific community. Science tends to be a little bit of aloof of rogues. You used that word earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm a bit of a rogue for, well, two reasons. One is that I'm pushing pleasure, but also, I'm a vegan. I'm an animal rights person, and that's not a comfort zone for most PhD scientists in this day and age or any other era. And so maybe that makes me even more of more of a rogue. I'm pushing the envelope. I want a new relationship with animals and humans because the one we have now is deeply troubled. So there's a very strong ethical bent to what I talk about and what I write about.
So really then, it sounds like it's not just the area that you've carved out more recently in your career, especially with these two books, as you note, but sort of how you choose to live your life that is also maybe created like a little bit of a barrier for to be embraced by fellow scientists that work more loosely in the realm of animal behavior.
Well, I'm speculating on that. I mean, but that's certainly my impression. I mean, a review of an earlier book, one of the very few negative reviews, was written by a poultry scientist, and it was written for a journal called Animal Behavior, which is sort of the most important journal in my particular field. And I was disappointed about that. I was glad they reviewed it, but it was given a pretty dismissive review. And I think that's fairly representative of a good number of scientists out there who may be looking at my work.
And not to have you, you know, relive too much of this painful memory of that review, but I'd be curious just in a quick summary, like what was the stance he took in sort of being, it sounds like, rather dismissive of the book?
Well, I try not to read negative reviews over and over again.
Okay, right.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I read that one.
Okay, all right.
But probably really partly back to that privacy issue.
Yeah.
I can see scientists feeling like I'm a bit liberal with my interpretations of what animals may be feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, again, I'm an envelope pusher, but really there's very, very sound evolutionary adaptive arguments for animals feeling pleasure. It's really not going very much out on a limb to say that one owl feels good when being groomed or preened by another owl, or when two animals are having sexual congress, that there isn't any pleasure there, or when rats come running to the hand to be flipped over on their backs and tickled in the belly and they make these ultrasonic squeaks that are associated with good feelings, that they're not feeling pleasure. So I don't want to make this sound like it's controversial. It really isn't controversial. It's
mm-hmm.
just that scientists aren't especially comfortable with it.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I've just gotten the sense from following, you know, your career, first chance we've had to talk, but yeah, that there is kind of a, I guess this kind of sense of a lot of scientists kind of looking down their nose at the work that you've been sort of carving out. And is it just like you said, I mean, you can't really, get into animals' feelings for a lot of those scientific academic types to feel comfortable. Is it also related to that there aren't as many, sort of measurable, demonstrable things that do make scientist types more comfortable in the world that you're sort of exploring and writing about?
Well, scientists are incredibly have great ingenuity when they put their minds to it, and actually pleasure is measurable. It's not something that's terminally private. I mean, we can dogmatically say that feelings are private. I mean, your feelings are private to me. I can't actually experience your pain or pleasure in the direct physical sense. You may tell me that you're feeling that, but you could be lying or you could be a robot. I mean, you know, we can get really dogmatic about that, but ultimately every other being has private experiences. But they're very clever ways of measuring pleasure. I mentioned rats running to the hand to be tickled. I mean, that was a study that showed that they run much faster than they do if they're expecting to be petted in the neck. Rats play wrestle when they're young, and they tickle each other in the belly, and they make these ultrasonic chirps. And by the way, with new scanning imaging technology, brain imaging technology, we can see that areas of their brain that are active during these tickling bouts are the same areas that are active while we are laughing or feeling a mirthful response to something. So some very, very robust scientific parallels can be drawn between animals physiologically, biochemically, behaviorally. So as I say, I mean, there's some really, really clever stuff out there in the scientific journals, not necessarily in the context of pleasure always presented,
mm-hmm.
but pleasure is part of the equation, and I've been sort of rooting that out and bringing it to light in my work.
Sure, absolutely. Well, let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Jonathan Balcom, who holds a PhD in ethology, the study of animal behavior, and is the author most recently of The Exultant Ark, a pictorial tour of animal pleasure. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Jonathan a question about animal pleasure or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So yeah, so it sounds like, I mean, the things you just described, I mean, and the elements thereof sound like good science.
Yeah, it is good science. And I mean, I'm a scientist. I've learned the methods, and I think it's important to be rigorous in our efforts to understand what animals may be thinking and feeling. And it is an exciting time to be an ethologist. There's a journal now called Animal Cognition, for instance, that is a journal dedicated to thinking and rational and cognitive skills in animals. And animal emotion is getting a lot more interest. And, of course, pleasure is part of that. Animal virtue is getting more attention as well. And this speaks to a broader message I have about wild nature in particular, and that is that it's so commonly portrayed as an earnest struggle to survive. If you turn on the TV to a nature documentary, you're most likely you're going to see an emphasis on predator-prey interactions. You're going to see an emphasis on competition. You're going to see usually a neglect of things like cooperation, mutualisms. And part of my argument about wild nature is that we've had it wrong. Sure, there are struggles in life, as we know from our own lives, but actually there's a lot of rewards in life. Life is worth living for other animals as well, and pleasures, the various types of pleasure they can experience that I bring to light in this book, is part of that. There's a lot of give and give. It's not just give and take in nature. Mutualisms abound, and this book is rife with examples of not just one animal getting pleasure at the expense of another, but much more commonly, one animal getting pleasure while the other one also derives pleasure from the interaction.
Yeah, sharing that pleasure, absolutely. Well, I suppose, really, that at least for us lay people, if not also for those more squarely in the scientific academic world, I mean, one could arguably find glibbers of that kind of evidence just around the house. I mean, just looking no further than the cats or dogs, you know, in their living room, where daily you see plenty of pleasure.
And you do. I've lived with rats, and I now currently live. I've lived with many cats over the years. I currently live with two cats. And I haven't tried rats and cats at the same time, although that might work.
That could compromise somebody's pleasure in that equation, possibly, but maybe not. Yeah.
But animals learn the rules. They know how to behave. They take their cues from us. So
yeah.
I'm sure there are many good cat relationships out there. And if you go on YouTube, you can probably find a few.
I'm sure.
So one of my cats is an absolute hedonist. If she sees me nearby, she'll make a particular vocalization. It's sort of a chirp. She'll run ahead and flop down on the carpet. And I actually put a video on YouTube called Cat Pleasure where I demonstrate this. I thump the brush on the carpet. She comes running, and I give her a brush. And she's flopping around, and she just absolutely adores it. And why does she adore it? Well, touch is very pleasurable to us. We know that. And studies show that touch is pleasurable to other animals and even cats, which really evolved as a relatively solitary creature. But she is absolutely obsessed with being brushed and stroked.
And the thing, absolutely, I mean, I think we probably all would have, you know, a counterpart, you know, sort of a anecdote or just daily experience to report like that. But even if you sort of widen out from there, whether it's, you know, say horses or go broader, like in here, you know, you see gators doing things that, when they're not attacking people, but just, you know, soaking up the sun and other things that, you know, you can just sort of, well, at least you think you can just, you know, observe their pleasure. And then, something a few times you talk about in the book is you lucky enough to live near a sanctuary. And for those of us who have been to sanctuaries or can go and again, observe what kind of, interactions and behavior takes place there, especially when they're, you know, safer and a lot of the captive elements, you know, are sort of lifted or eased. Again, demonstrations of pleasure. And then further out from there, if you're in the wild, if you're lucky enough to, say, go to Kenya and see elephants, you know, playing basically in a water hole, again, that's more than just cooling off. They're having fun and they're playing with each other and everybody's getting a lot of pleasure from that. So.
Yeah, well said. That's a nice example, actually, of the synergy between what's adaptive and what's pleasurable. I mean, the way I like to put it is just as pain is nature's way of punishing maladaptive behavior, behavior that may risk death or injury. Pleasure is nature's way of saying, good boy, good girl, you did the right thing. It's sort of nature's carrot, if you like, in a carrot and stick world. It encourages animals to do good things, to find food, to eat food, to find mates, mating partners, to get warm. You mentioned alligators sunbathing. So sunbathing for a reptile, what we'd call an ectotherm, meaning an animal who loosely is called cold-blooded, it's not actually cold-blooded. Their blood gets very warm, but they have to get in the sun to do that. They rely on the sun. So very important, very adaptive for them to be in the sun. But are we then to conclude that they don't actually get pleasure from that? On the contrary, I would argue that the reason they feel pleasure for that is because it's adaptive. It behooves nature. It behooves evolutionary theory. It behooves alligators to be encouraged, to be motivated to go and lie in the sun. They don't just do it because of some kind of unknown force that tells them they must do this. They do it because they want to. They're not thinking about Darwinian evolution, as far as I know. I don't think alligators are really into that.
Their studies are limited in that way.
In their environment, and it feels good.
For sure. Well, that's the thing. So I guess because I'm sort of interested in some ways just because of again the book, which I just want to emphasize, and we'll get in a few more specifics too about the photos and maybe the approach that you took to it in a moment. But it's both things really kind of in important, if not equal measure. I mean, this is maybe still this term is used, kind of a coffee table book in the sense that it's good size and the photos are, many pages huge or full size or double pages across pages and just gorgeous. But, it's a lot more than that too. As I said in the introduction, I mean, it's, you've written a lot of accompanying text and there's categories. To further sort of underscore like where the scientific community may or may not embrace, some of the work and yet what seems to be here in a pretty inarguable way. I mean, one thing to do is to point to the category, for example, the food category where as animals behave flexibly and hedonically, I guess, and the human infant's facial expressions and gestures, mirror those of animal infants. Or even feeding behavior, just, the way that they're smelling a flower. I mean, these are all things that, maybe in one or two cases isolated may or may not say much, but when you start to look at the body things, even just in each of these categories that you choose to present in this book, it'd be pretty, you'd be pretty hard pressed, even as a hard-nosed scientist, I would think, to say, well, okay, that's all well and good, but, how does that show me that they're experiencing pleasure and that they're feeling pleasure?
Right, and I think context is so important, and also we have the comparison, we have the knowledge that we experience pleasure, and we see other animals behaving, doing something that we do, and we know it brings pleasure to us, we know it's important to them, and we do have those studies that show that their brains actually register, show the same kind of chemical releases and neural patterns that we have when we're feeling pleasure. So really, it's a combination of empathy to look at these pictures and say, look, I know what it's like to eat a mango, a ripe mango. I can see this bat licking her lips as she chows down on a nice ripe mango. I might really think that she's not feeling pleasure. I mean, most people are going to look at that and say, yeah, I imagine that bat is actually really quite enjoying that meal. And so there is an exercise in empathy there where we cross that species barrier and we naturally relate to another individual who has a life, who has senses, who has a brain, has a mind, has emotions. And then there's the science, which is more revealed in the text of the book, which makes the case perhaps more rigorously. But really, this is first and foremost, as you say, a coffee table book. People enjoy drinking coffee, so I think coffee goes very well with a book on pleasure. And it's a book to just leaf through, and any time I open it, even though I've seen all of these photos many times, I selected them out of hundreds, if not thousands, of photos. Every time I see them, they speak to me, they give me a good feeling, they give me pleasure, And that resonates nicely with the subject.
Cool. Well, I want to get more a little bit more, as I said, into that process in just a moment. But, again, I'm Duncan Strasser. My guest is Jonathan Balcom, whose latest book is The Exultant Arc, a pictorial tour of animal pleasure. And we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. Let's take a caller here and get them involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jonathan Balcom. Hello. Hello, it's you. Hello. Last call, I hear you there, but you're not responding. Okay. Let's go right to an email then. Why do you think, first of all, the subject line of this email says great guest, and then the question is, why do you think that there is more emphasis on the predator-prey relationships on TV? Do filmmakers find playful relationships boring?
It's a great question, and really my response is mostly speculative. I think the boring suggestion is maybe one explanation. I have heard from wildlife filmmakers, and I'm interested actually in developing a documentary on animal pleasure right now. I'm working on that. But I have heard from experts that the primary target demographic of nature documentary programs and Animal Planet type stuff is males in their mid-20s. And that demographic is seen as a sports-loving, they like the violence, that kind of conflict kind of oriented stuff. So that's perhaps one answer. Perhaps a subtler reason, is it just my own speculation here, is that maybe it makes us feel a little bit more at ease with our very troubled relationship with animals. If we see that nature is cruel and harsh and Hobbesian and blood red and tooth and claw and all that kind of stuff, we kill 10 billion animals a year in this country alone. We kill 300 chickens a second. I mean, there's a lot of violence going on out there. A lot of it's hidden behind closed doors. But people go to the supermarket, they buy meat. Some of them actually think about it and may have some misgivings about that. Well, if we think, well, nature's cruel and horrible anyway, so what's the difference? I'm part of nature. I think it may be one way to make us feel a little bit more at ease about that relationship.
That's it. Yeah, you know, in fact, in thinking about chatting with this morning, I was thinking that as far as, like, you know, the certain resistance that we talked about a little bit now already, you know, not only in the scientific world, but maybe, you know, a bigger faction of just the population. I'm just wondering, would it prove sort of too slippery a slope to really acknowledge this kind of, sense of animal pleasure that is kind of the core of the book and your other book and your recent work? I mean, because from there, would it be not too far from having to acknowledge then if they can experience that kind of pleasure, then they clearly, despite what I otherwise might have thought, experience, you know, mistreatment, cruelty, pain. And from there, then you're saying, you know, fishing, for example, to pick a big Florida activity, becomes something someone does knowingly causing pain where, you know, if they've kind of set up kind of a nice little curtain of denial about the pleasure part of what animals can experience, then they're good on you know, causing the pain and injury part.
Well, if that's all a slippery slope, then I sure hope I'm lubricating it, because I want us to move towards a new relationship with animals. I've actually written about and read a great deal about pain in fishes, for instance, and so yeah. while it may be fun to go fishing, it's not fun for the fish, and we do need to think more about what it's like for the party on the other end of the line or the end of our fork, and it's not just for the better for the animals. I'm not going to go into a diatribe about all the other benefits of eating lower on the food chain, but there are a lot of other benefits in addition to animal welfare. So I hope that slope gets steeper, and I hope it gets slipperier.
Okay. Well, all right, so let's talk a little bit more about just sort of nuts and bolts in a way about how you approach the book. I mean, were the photos – did it always start off to be a kind of a photo book from the beginning, and then you made reference to seeing all these different photos and sort of picking through them, but did you commission some or all the photos, or what was the process really for what I now hold in my hand?
The book was always intended to be a photo book. I wrote a book that came out in 2006 called Pleasurable Kingdom, Animals and the Nature of Feeling Good, and that was a non-pictorial treatment. That was a detailed treatise on the subject, albeit for lay readers. And so I'd done that. But I felt, you know, animals are a beautiful thing, and pleasure is a beautiful subject. Why not combine the two in a pictorial? And so the publisher, in this case, University of California Press, were very keen on the idea right off the get-go. And then the other part of your question, I mean, it was part of the adventure and excitement of doing this, was seeing what photos would come in through my email or, you know, when people directed me to their website. And there was a lot of filtering to be done, but that was part of the labor of love of doing this book was I already had a good sense of the structure of the book. I knew I wanted to touch on some of the main categories. You've mentioned some of them already, play, food, touch, and then some less often ones associated with animals, such as love and comfort and companionship. Of course, sex is in there as well. So I already had a sense of the structure, but I knew I wanted to talk about the neglect of pleasure and then the realms of pleasure. That's the main thing, is this presentation of here's the way animals can feel pleasure. And, of course, the end of the book gets into the more cerebral implications, the significance of pleasure.
Sure. Well, you brought up the sort of the courtship and sex thing. That's another, category that I think, you know, again, to almost anyone would sort of unequivocally, you know, really underscore that animals do experience pleasure and seek it. And really, the bonobos, seem to be a classic example. I mean, they're having sex much more than just for procreation. So the preconceptions about animal sex sometimes, are just that, a preconception, then that it's an instinctive act whereas you point out that it's versatile, opportunistic, and sometimes creative, and no more so perhaps than with the bonobos. But you certainly cite some other examples too that I think make it just unquestionable that sometimes these animals are having as much fun and pleasure with sex as any of us would.
Well, I got to tell you, 6 weeks ago, I was at a tea shop in England with my elderly aunt, who I hadn't seen for a while, and I handed them the book as a gift. And my main thought was, please don't turn to page 91, which has a picture of, a giraffe penis on it as they're mating.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty graphic image.
Yeah.
And sure enough, my 95-year-old great aunt turned directly to page 91. But she's a seasoned veteran of life. She wasn't fazed. But certainly a book on pleasure must include sex as a subject.
Sure. Absolutely. So even though obviously we're talking on the radio, so people listening, unless they, you know, scooted around on the internet, can't really see any images at the moment. But still, nonetheless, could you just describe maybe three or so of your very favorite photos that are in the book for those who perhaps will be getting the book sometime soon, and why they particularly strike you even now?
Okay. There's a picture of two gray-headed flying foxes. These are actually bats, but they look more like dogs in the face. And there, it's a mother and her pup, her young, who's probably several weeks old now. He's getting close to adult size. And to look at the photo, you might think they're kind of fighting, but they're actually play fighting. They're wrestling. It's something they do a lot of, sort of jousting. It's good practice, but it's also fun. And that's in the chapter on play.
Mm-hmm.
Another picture I think is really interesting because it's an interspecies interaction. It's langur monkeys grooming a dog.
Mm.
And it's been seen for decades now in parts of the drier parts of India, Rajasthan, Gujarat areas of India. And these dogs, which are technically, they're carnivores, they're predators. You could actually see them as a potential danger or menace to langur monkeys. But no, on the contrary, these two species have forged a positive relationship where the monkeys groom the dogs. Now, I don't know how well understood it is. I'm not sure if anyone's really studied it closely. But I would argue that pleasure is a big part of why it works and why it happens. I could speculate that there may be some give and take there, or give and give, I should say, a mutualism whereby the monkeys groom the dogs in exchange for protection, perhaps from the dogs. The dogs maybe sort of act as watchdogs, if you like,
sure,
and keep an eye out for danger. The dog may also benefit from the monkeys sounding the alarm if humans or some other danger is approaching. So that's an intriguing photo that I knew of that interaction. I'd seen a picture. I really wanted it in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then one other one, just a really prosaic one, a goat giving himself a back scratch. This is photographed on an animal sanctuary out in California, run by Farm Sanctuary for rescued farmed animals.
Sure.
And goats are fortunate. They have a built-in back scratcher on the top of their head, and they will often lean their head back and to relieve an itch on their back. An itch isn't fun, but relieving an itch can feel really quite satisfying. And in this book, this particular photo really kind of conveys that.
Cool. And so, Jonathan, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time here. But what kind of ambitions did you have for yourself in approaching the writing of the text for a book that was obviously, you know, always intended to be photo oriented, but clearly there must have been some real thinking about, okay, what kind of text and how far do I take it and how scientific it versus, making sure that the lay folks are still on board, et cetera.
Well, it's a university press, so it's pretty, it's not hard reading, but it's definitely written for it's a trade book nonetheless and a lay reader, but it's got some scholarliness to it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of science in there. And there's citations at the back of the book. And so I think of the text really as sort of a support, if you like, for the photos. To reiterate, this book is first and foremost to be opened up and leafed through and gasped at, I hope. And the text is there for people for whenever they want to delve a little deeper to show that there's actually real science behind this. This isn't just sort of a collection of, oh, isn't that sweet and cute kind of stuff.
Right.
And this is a important argument that I'm making, and it speaks back to that bigger issue of the relationship between humans and the other animals, remembering, of course, that we are biologically animals ourselves.
Sure.
And it's a relationship that I really want to see evolve in a positive direction, and pleasure is part of that evolution.
Cool. Well, that makes great sense. And just before we go, since you alluded to this, I'd love to find out what the plans are, or how far along at least you are on the documentary that you just referred to a few minutes ago.
Well, I've written, thanks for asking, I've written a full treatment, which is essentially a 13-14-page narrative description of every scene, everything said. I hope to host it myself. And while I was in England working on this as a homework project, a BBC producer of the Natural History Unit, who just read a very favorable review in the New York Times, contacted me about this very thing. So a great synergy there, and I'm in discussions with the BBC right now. I mean, the BBC is widely regarded as the best natural history filmmaker in the world, so I'm very hopeful that will fly, but if not, there's some other possibilities. So I think of a documentary film as sort of the next phase of,
sure,
this grand animal pleasure project that I've been delighted to be involved in for a decade now.
Sure. Well, we certainly look forward to this. We've been speaking with Jonathan Balcom, whose latest book is called The Exultant Ark, A Pictorial Tour of Animal Pleasure. He has a wonderful website, Jonathan Balcom, BALCOMBE.com, and all kinds of great information and ways to find out more and find out about speaking engagements and other things are all located on that website. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Duncan, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. All right. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. All right. It's Talking Animals. Our show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize. Copy of Thunderdog, the book by last week's guest, Michael Hingston. To the first person who calls in 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, thematically relevant to our discussion we just had with Jonathan Balcom. Let's name that animal tune on Talking Animals.
Like I hold your head up high till you find a bluebird of happiness. You will find greater peace of mind knowing there's a bluebird of happiness. And when he sings to you, though you're deep in blue, you will see a ray of light creep through. And so remember this. Life is no abyss. night. Somewhere there's a bluebird. I've had a little there. What I had to what? Do in the bottom, 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 bottom.
All right, well, we got one caller. Maybe they'll see if we'll take the others off the air. But hi, you're on Talk Animals. Can you name that animal tune? Hello?
Bird of Happiness?
That's right. What is your first name, sir?
Harry.
Harry? All right, cool. It is indeed the Bluebird of Happiness. Seemed appropriate. So, Harry, if you'll I'll put you back on hold, and we'll get your information and send you off a copy of... The book that we kind of spotlighted with our guest last week, Thunderdog, and Michael Hinkson, and sort of a very timely thing with the 10th anniversary of 9/11. This is the story about the blind man who was led to safety by his guide dog Roselle from the 78th floor of the North Tower of the Twin Towers. So, thanks for listening, and congratulations, and we'll come back and get your information in one set.
Thank you.
All right, so let's see. We are going to hear get a few more animal news items, including related to the awful, awful fires in Central Texas. And this is from the Austin American Statesman. The wildfires that have raged across Central Texas since Sunday, prompting thousands of residents to evacuate their homes, have also uprooted animals. As shelters at Bastrop and Leander were evacuated in the past few days, dogs and cats have wound up in Austin shelters. Displaced farm animals have also found their way here. Quote, the Bastrop Animal Shelter had to be evacuated on Sunday night. We drove down there and took about 60 dogs from them, said Melissa Miller of Austin Pets Alive, a nonprofit organization dedicated to saving shelter animals. Tuesday, the group also took in dogs from the Williamson County Animal Shelter in Georgetown when that facility had to make room for animals from an evacuated Leander shelter. The Georgetown facility is taking in other animals displaced by the wildfires. We're trying to make room for those displaced by pets by getting the adoptable pets out of there, Miller said. To create that room, Austin Pets Alive waived its adoption fees Monday and Tuesday. That resulted in a record-high adoption day Monday. Well, people came out in droves, came out with donations. Most said it was absolutely insane, but it was really great to see the community support. Less people fear the rate of the fate of animals animals adopted on a whim during a crisis. Miller said studies show the return rate for reduced fee or no fee pet adoptions is no different than that of regular adoptions. And there was something else that I was going to... Yeah, I wanted to mention that the Association of Zoos and Aquariums adopts new policy that bans elephant bullhooks. They adopted this policy recently, requiring all AZA-accredited facilities to switch to protected contact elephant management. That means no more use of the abusive bullhooks, which are sharp steel-tipped weapons that resemble a fireplace poker, for any zoos that wants to be accredited by the AZA. So, again, a whole nother conversation we've had many times on this show about whether elephants should be in zoos. No. But any progress is good progress. And so if we get bullhooks out of all those places, those are important steps forward. So, all right. So I think that's it for our animal news for today. And I think what we're going to do is, we're just about sort of really at the end of our today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. So we'll be back next Wednesday, September 14th, when our guest will be vegan black metal chef, the culinary sensation who's exploded on the internet. Or maybe he's the YouTube sensation who's exploded onto the culinary scene. At any rate, he makes vegan cooking videos set to black metal, spiced with more than a little humor. The videos are terrific, and I heard him speak on a panel over the weekend, and it turns out that vegan black metal chef is also really smart, articulate, and funny, and he's our guest next Wednesday, September 14th. I hope you'll join me then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net. where we make available all sorts of information as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals shows. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls version of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune, also reflecting a bit of animal pleasure in a sense, involving elephants dancing with joy and all. This is Maceo Parker with Elephant Foot, taking us up to the NPR News, and then Scott Elliott and his great, great show right here on WMNF Tampa. We'll see you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals.
While killing one day, not knowing what to do, I thought I'd get my friend and go to the zoo. We didn't see an elephant or a cage. Someone had put them all on the stage. There were lumps and bumps and all kinds of grind. You know those elephants wouldn't stay in line. I said, I know just what they need. Let's teach them all to do the Wangman Reed. We practiced and practiced all day long to teach these elephants the elephant song. They looked at us with tight lips, just kept on moving those big elephant hips. And elephant dancing is a thing to see. And that's when I noticed they were looking at me. I said, come on, elephants, come on, let's go. And that's when one of them stepped on my toe. Ah! Elephant stepped on my foot. 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 You must give elephant a dirty look. Limits. Elephant dancing is a pretty good gimmick. I looked at my watch, it was getting late. It was about time to open the gate. People came in to see the show. Someone said, hey, look, that's Maceo. I said, can I have your attention, please? These elephants are about to dance you down to your knees. They bumped and grind and swayed all day. Started thinking about after the show, hey. I said, come on, it's not time to eat. We got to get the crowd up off their feet. We got to keep going for a while yet. Gotta help your owner out of debt. I said, anyway, after this, there's another show. And again, same elephant, same toe. Ah. Elephant stepped on my foot. 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 Elephant stepped on my foot.
You must give elephant a dirty look.
I know what I'll do. I'll feed him some of this.
It's 88.5.